Good evening, James McKinney here with my Science Hour, August 24th, 2017. And tonight I was going to announce a book release. I ended up leaving last week on what was going to be a two-day trip. Ended up being a week trip. So anyway, I apologize. And so I'm postponing my release until everything is done with that particular volume. So sorry about that. I feel worse than you do, believe me. I'm going to talk about tonight the total eclipse, some follow-up material on that, and then also the idea that NASA wants to pump water, drill a hole and then pump water into the Yellowstone volcano. real bad idea. Not only bad, I mean, it's just moronic because... anyway, I'll be discussing that little issue. The sale on the webpage I'm taking down. Finally, I'm going to have a few minutes here. I'll be taking that extra 5% down. So if you can get there before that's taken off, then lucky you. But also the multi-round, the MR5 and 9 filters still have that sale on where it's like 10% off plus an extra 5% off the main unit, and then the filter replacement packs are not half price, but very close to half price. Limited time offer, that's when you buy the replacement packs with the initial unit, and that's going away here also in about a day. So if you are thinking about that, for using that filter for a whole house filter, go there and order that right now. The way you do that is by sending an email, and hopefully shortly I will have some buttons up there where you can order directly. And that will be through PayPal. All the rest on my homepage, order page, is through the merchant account. But those are larger ticket items, so they have to go through PayPal. But in the meantime, just send in an email to the address there, jmcc@jmcanneyscience.com. That address is on the webpage. And send me an email as to what you want, and then I send you a PayPal invoice by email, and that's how the purchase is completed as things are right now. On the wing generator, what I'm doing, I've realized I have to somewhat screen people before putting out licenses for development. And so anyway, on the webpage, you can also donate if you'd like to donate. There's a donate button there. But for licensing, I have to spend a little bit of time screening people so that they understand what it's all about. And I'll just talk about this briefly on the air so the public understands also where this is at. I had a major player go south on me in over the last month or so. And it's very difficult to, anyway, I'm not going to go into details. However, so right now, basically, it's going to be a bit longer until we get production wing models out. And so for licensing, and what I want to do by this licensing, understand, is have groups of people, and this is already going on in the background, so some good work has been going on in the background here, in spite of, like I say, one major player just basically going south. And I'm not sure. I don't really understand people. But that's neither here nor there. It wouldn't be the first time in the life of this project that that's happened. And it's mainly because people don't know how to communicate. And don't, you know, they don't understand what's involved here. But basically what I'm looking for when I talk about developers, I need people that have certain skills. And very likely, one person or one group of people that work together are not going to have all the skills necessary to complete a marketable wing generator. And it's something that requires talents. And so what I've done is put together teams, and these teams are working together in the background. It's really a good way to work, but people have to understand, I don't send out a design and say, here, build this. Basically, people have to be creative. People have to understand the dangers of working with, say, electrical equipment. And so for some people, they simply don't have the proper skills to work with the electrical part of the wing generator. And there's many other aspects. It's a very complicated project. And so anyway, there's some great work going on in the background in spite of some difficulties recently. And so anyway, I will keep you posted. That's all I can tell you on that vein. But the licensing, what I've done is I'm just going to have people email, and then I'll talk to them and make sure they understand. And then there's the agreement and licensing, which is an ongoing process. There's fees involved, a startup fee, and then monthly fees, etc. So anyway, it's rather complicated. So anyway, the way I'm working the wing licensing is, first I'm just interviewing people to make sure that they're on the right page and understand everything that's involved. By the way, this is not a garage project where you just throw something together in your garage. Certainly many things start that way, but understand that these things have to go into production, and there's all of the standard testing and other, all the standard engineering practices, including communications. So it's not like people should go back into their closet and try and develop something and then come out at a later date. It has to be constant communication, and I mean constant. So it's something that people have to put time and effort into and money, and also communicate, because there's a lot of other people involved here. So anyway, I'm not going to say any more than that, other than I will be talking directly to people that are interested in licensing to develop, etc. So on to the main science topic. I'll be talking about the eclipse. Now, on August 10th, I gave some major discussions about the eclipse. And I was called, Tuesday morning on the Power Hour, as they had some listener input asking about the eclipse and the fact that I had made a public statement that the eclipse could have been used by amateur astronomers, having hundreds, if not thousands, of amateur astronomers taking real data of the sun and the star patterns around the sun, and basically disprove general relativity. So for some of you, that might sound like a complicated topic, but it's really rather rudimentary. The Einsteinian concept was that it's basically a thought experiment. And by the way, I talk about this in my DVD number 4, the University Level Astronomy, Astrophysics, Space Science course. I discuss this in detail there, and I also show data which disproves general relativity. And just to begin with, special relativity and general relativity are somewhat related, but very different. Special relativity was the first major relativity theory from Einstein. It came in around 1905, and there's basically, he put the key in the lock, removed the sword from the stone, if you will, and many, many great scientists, physicists had worked around this problem Literally for about 20 years since the Michelson-Morley experiment, which I believe was 1887 when the Michelson-Morley experiment was performed, and 1905, which was 18 years later, Einstein came up with the solution. And it was very simple. And when you think about it, when we look in retrospect, it was a very simple statement that light moves in a frame of reference at a constant velocity. And so if you're, say, moving at near the speed of light and you send a light signal away from you, it will leave you at the speed of light. But say you're approaching a planet or a solar system, you're coming at near the speed of light, and somebody's in that solar system, relatively stationary. When the light beam that you release gets to them, they receive it at the speed of light. Now, this typically doesn't make, this wouldn't make any sense at all. And that's why it took many years for people to understand this, and then there were further experiments done. And the bottom line was you had Lorentz and Michelson and Morley, the originators, who did the experiment, which showed there was no ether. There was no transmittal medium for electromagnetic radiation to be transmitted. Like waves in an ocean, the water is the medium. Sound waves, air is the medium. And that's why in outer space, there are no sounds. And so the medium, they were looking for a medium for the transmittal of electromagnetic radiation. This is 1887, the Michelson-Morley experiment. And they found, they got a null result. In other words, there was no detection of ether. So this confused people. And Einstein's solution, if he wouldn't have come up with that, possibly today we would still be grappling around that idea because it was very subtle what he did. Like I say, people had worked around this for decades and touched on it. We had the Lorentz transformation already done that translates between frames of reference, etc. But Einstein was the guy that put the, like I say, the key in the lock, turned it, and opened it up for everybody to see. And for that, it was a tremendous advancement, one of those little things that changes the course of physics, which is a major discovery. Okay, so that's special relativity, and there are many, many experiments that prove that special relativity is correct, along with all of the other nuances, not the least of which is the equation E is equal to mc squared, which talks about the translation of matter into energy and vice versa, but showing that a small amount of matter can produce a tremendous amount of energy and, of course, leading to atomic energy. So special relativity is a magnificent piece of work. However, general relativity is a different story. And basically, and I've talked about this before, I'll just repeat it briefly. If you did a series of experiments in an elevator, say you're in an elevator and you're out in outer space, completely away from everything, and you have a rocket motor on your elevator and you're accelerating at, say, the surface gravity of the sun, you're accelerating whatever the surface gravity of the sun that's equal to your acceleration in the elevator. So you do a bunch of experiments, and the principle of equivalence says that if you did those same experiments on the surface of the sun, then they should turn out the same. You should not, if you were in a closed elevator box sitting on the surface of the sun, which of course would be pretty warm, but these are think experiments, just dealing with the gravitational aspect of this, all of those experiments should turn out the same. That's the principle of equivalence. Now, as you're accelerating in your elevator shaft out in the middle of space in the middle of nowhere, if you shine a light into one side and a hole in one side of your elevator box, then it should curve down in a parabolic shape, reacting to the acceleration. And so the principle of equivalence would suggest that if you did a light experiment, similar light experiment at the surface of the sun, then you should see a bending of light. And there's other principles of equivalence that deals with redshift and other aspects of general relativity. And so anyway, that's an assumption. Now, to prove it, you would need a very massive body in your laboratory, which we can't do. We can do gravitational experiments, which are very sensitive. The Cavendish balance was designed to measure gravitational forces in the laboratory, and we can do that. But to get a mass the size of the sun in your laboratory, not very practical. In fact, it's impossible. So the idea was that if you could take a picture of the sky with the star pattern and then take a picture of that same region of the sky but during a solar eclipse, then the stars should appear to move outwards in your photograph because the light is bending around the sun. And so the star pattern all around the sun that's being blocked out by the full moon or by the full disk of the moon, not the full moon, because the full moon is on the other side of Earth when we have a full moon. So I just want to clarify that. But the entire lunar disk covering up the sun, and then you can see stars like as if it were nighttime. So you have a window of a couple minutes in which to take your pictures. And so anyway, the original Eddington data, which we have, does not at all corroborate general relativity. But what Eddington did, Arthur Eddington, 1919, went down to an island called Principe off the African coast, and or was it the South American coast? I forget, whatever. And did an experiment with telescope taking a picture during the total eclipse. And did literally, if you look at the photographs that were taken by Eddington of the 50 or so stars, he cherry-picked the data, like I said, and the movement of the stars should be radially outwards from the center of the sun. The majority of them are not, and also as you get out farther away from the sun, the displacement, the movement, or the bending should be less. And as you get farther away from, in the photos, as you get farther away from the sun, a lot of the motion of the stars out there becomes greater. So anyway, Eddington fudged the data. Nobody reproduced the data. Nobody went in and followed up afterwards. And so I was going to send out for amateur astronomers to do this study, but about it was probably over 10 years ago. It was around 2004, I believe it was. I have this posted on my webpage, by the way. And I have the form that was sent out in the study, and I had a special webpage, and I had an email address set up. And it was for amateur astronomers around the world to look at comets. And there were two comets that were going to have a planetary electrical alignment, which they were going to then produce sunward spikes. And since we were looking from the broadside, the side of the comet, that would prove conclusively that the spike of the comet is not an optical illusion, but in fact a sunward spike. And the webpage got hacked. The email got basically hacked. The emails did not get to me that were coming from amateur astronomers. And I got feedback from the amateur astronomers, some of them that actually got threatened when they were trying to pursue sending me data. And then NASA opened up its own comet watch for these particular comets and scarfed up the data. And of course they hid everything that came in, actually literally setting up the same worldwide data gathering operation with amateur astronomers. So they just short-circuited my program. And so what I realized that if I put something out there, I could literally be putting amateur astronomers in danger. And so anyway, that's not why I did it. So I was hoping that amateur astronomers would hear my message, not by receiving emails, and then eventually be able to get some data to me. And the data would consist of hundreds of amateur astronomers along the eclipse line taking photographs during total eclipse when in their area and showing the patterns of the stars with their equipment and with video. Some people even have very high resolution video equipment. You would be able to see in that 2 to 3 minute window, you would be able to see the stars actually moving around out there. And that would show conclusively that that isn't due to gravity, because gravity is constant, and the gravity of the sun, and therefore disproving general relativity. But anyway, I'm still working on this in the background, hoping that some of the data, some of the materials that have been sent in will be fruitful. But isn't it amazing what you have to go through today to actually do real science and how it's being blocked at every corner? Let me explain just a couple other things. I've talked about this before. The satellite data, when I was at Cornell, there were meetings after class in the afternoon every day, the 2 or 3 data sessions where data had come in from various experiments or whatever. And I went to as many of these as I could, because that's when I was, you know, the confluence of data and my theoretical work, etc., was going on. And the one session, they had a satellite that was orbiting Venus. So we knew exactly where that satellite was, and they were going to try and use the radio signal from that satellite coming back to Earth to do some fine-tuning on general relativity. Well, it turned out that the data looked like Venus was bouncing all over the place as Venus went around behind the sun from our viewpoint. And the data showed Venus like just moving all over the place. And of course, we knew that wasn't the case. So the meeting turned into all of the correction factors that would have to be applied to general relativity to account for this anomalous data. And so anyway, I knew, you know, I was seeing these experiments, seeing their experimental results, knowing that I was right with my induced electric dipole redshift. That was laboratory provable. You can show it very easily in a laboratory. And the another case was during the Voyager passage of Jupiter and Saturn. I talk about this in my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. But the Marconi oscillators are used for they're a tuned frequency oscillator that is used for the transmitting and receiving radio signals. So as the Voyager spacecraft approached Jupiter, the Marconi oscillators redshifted the frequency. Well, the Marconi oscillator did not redshift, but the frequency did as it came back to Earth. Well, that indicated that Jupiter was causing a redshift, which it is too small. It's not big enough gravitationally to cause the general relativistic redshift, which is a form of bending of light, if you will. And so once again, proving that the effect, and that's when I was very conclusive that Jupiter had a fusion in its atmosphere, and it had an electric field, non-uniform electric field, just like the sun. And so also another proving point for that was the fact that Jupiter had a proton wind coming off of it. It was measured by Voyager. Actually, it slipped through and was published in one of the science articles. And I'm sure the scientists didn't know the meaning of that. But once again, they were looking at data that they didn't understand. Later, that would have been edited out of there because it corroborates what I was doing. And then the third thing that happened was actually in around 1986. Some scientists went to South America to take spectrographic data of Halley's Comet, and what they saw was that the light coming from Halley's Comet was redshifted. Well, it's not due to special relativity redshift, because the velocity and path of Halley's Comet was well known, and the it was not due to general relativity, the other possible theoretical source of redshift, because Halley's Comet is like a little piece of 7-mile-long asteroid. So that certainly was not causing the redshift. So once again, you have redshift data coming from an electrically active comet, but then again, standard science thought that comets should be dirty snowballs. So how do you get a redshift there? So they fudged the data again. You see, the history of fudging data is just rampant. There's other measurements regarding redshift. There's a redshift that comes from our own sun, and the farther away you get from the sun, the greater the redshift. Anyway, I could go on and on, but the eclipse that just occurred was a pristine opportunity, and I wasn't there myself. I have been on assignment, you just might say. But anyway, I was not there, and planned not going anyway because of the high number of people, the very large numbers of people trying to get to locations where there was an eclipse. So anyway, but due to other factors, I was not able to attend. Very important, though. This is extremely important scientific material that, first of all, you're only going to hear about on this show. And second of all, to understand the degraded state of standard science today. And basically the garbage science that's pawned off on the public, and the fact that tier two scientists just are clueless. They have no idea what's going on out there, and all the glossy magazines, etc. So I'm not going to bark about that anymore, but still looking, hoping to find some real data coming in from this solar eclipse to put together enough data where it's viable to present to the public. On to the next topic. And by the way, if you know anybody that does have pictures of the sun with stars visible, then please send it to the email address on my webpage. That email address is jmcc@jmcanniescience.com. And it's, once again, jmcc@jmccanny2nscience.com. So jmcc@jmcanniescience.com. And by the way, that's the same email address for the MR, the large commercial grade filters. It's the same address as you'll find on the webpage. Okay, on to the next topic. Now, this just came out this past week. This just surfaced. The BBC released an article that was given to them by a clown named Brian Wilcox. Works for JPL, NASA, and apparently this guy was on some kind of a board to protect Earth, you know, to study Earth dangers and see what NASA could do to protect Earth. anyway, they came up with the bright idea, which is not a bright idea at all, that they recognized that there was a danger at Yellowstone. Well, duh, you know, there's no rocket science there. Yes, there's a danger at Yellowstone. I've talked about that. And I've talked about the fact that we have to drain the lake at Yellowstone. And the reason is because every time in history there has been a major volcano at Yellowstone, the caldera used to be in what is now the state of Idaho. And it's moved through all the way to Wyoming, etc. But that's where the hot spot had moved. But there have been three major, what we call super volcanoes, that the explosion threw ash around all the way to the Mississippi River in some cases. I have the maps of this posted on my webpage. And so the explosions occurred, the three major ones out of the dozens of eruptions that have occurred, the three major ones have occurred when there was a lake in the caldera. And now we have a fourth occurrence where there's a lake in the caldera. All of the other eruptions were just local lava flows. So empirically, that tells you that the water in the lake is instrumental in causing these super volcanoes to explode. And the standard moron geologist out there who got an A in geology in college or grad school dealing with volcanoes, they think that the explosive gases are down in the magma. Well, if they were going to explode, they would explode. I mean, water is the thing that changes from a liquid into steam. That's why they use it in steam engines, boys and girls. They don't use alcohol vapor. They don't use carbon dioxide vapor. They use water. Water works in steam engines for a reason. Water has very special properties. There's a lot of energy, and when you turn it into steam, it has the ability to expand. Let me tell you an experiment. Actually, this was told to be to me by my uncle, since deceased, unfortunately. But when he was in engineering school as a young lad, they took a big steel ball. And this was a solid steel ball about the size, let's say, about a foot and a half in diameter. So let's say the size of a bowling ball, but a solid steel ball. And they drilled a hole all the way down into the center. And then they tapped it so you could put a screw in there and seal it. Okay, and they did two things. They had like two of these. One of them, they put water in, and there was not very much water. As I recall, it was just a number of drops of water, and then they sealed it up with the sealing screw, and they froze it. The freezing, when the transition of water expands between freezing and unfreezing, it cracked the steel ball in two. Okay, a couple drops of water. Now they took another steel ball, the same type of deal, where they drilled a small hole down into the center, and then drilled, tapped out for a screw to seal it, in a long screw that went down the entire length of the hole down to the center of this steel ball, and they put a few drops of water, enough to fill up the little cavity in the middle. And they brought the temperature of the steel ball up to the boiling point of water. It broke the steel ball in two. Now, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, and ding-dong scientists at JPL, NASA, including Brian Wilcox, if you take, this is what the NASA proposal was. Remember, my proposal was you got to get the lake out of there. You got to drain the lake, and I've showed how to do it. There's a path, southeast corner of Yellowstone Lake, where you can just dig a trench, and the entire lake would drain out of there, and it would go down into the Scablands of Oregon, a relatively useless area where there's nothing going on, no use at all. Okay. And yeah, the lake is polluted, so you would pollute a certain area, but you wouldn't blow the world up. The NASA solution, in an internal meeting at NASA, decided behind closed doors, and then finally released last week to the BBC by Brian Wilcox, who apparently went on his own. I don't understand this, because NASA has release agencies and very strict rules about scientists going to the media. But so I can only assume that this was approved by NASA release agencies. But anyway, the plan that they dreamt up at NASA was to first drill a hole down into the magma at Yellowstone. Now, here I'm going to, and then they wanted to pump water into it. So I'll just give you the whole story to begin with. But anyway, let's go back to something called the BP. It's really a misnomer to call the BP oil spill an oil spill. It was the BP oil explosion underwater in the Gulf of Mexico. The British Petroleum had drilled a deep well. It was something like 18 miles deep. And when they hit the oil reserve down there, which was like a lake of oil, the pressure is extremely high down there because you have all this earth sitting on there and creating pressure. Okay, so the pressure is so high, if you poke a hole into the earth, then that pressure can come up to the surface in that hole, in that tube, and that's what happened. So it was not an oil spill. An oil spill is like when a boat tips over and oil goes in the water. That's an oil spill. This was an oil explosion, and they couldn't cap it. They could not find anything to stop the oil from flowing into the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm sure you all remember that. It went on and on and on, because British Petroleum, BP, drilled a hole down into the earth where the pressures are extremely high. So let me take another example that even probably a two-year-old would understand. If you take a balloon, you know, you blow up a balloon, it's got the rubber shell around the outside and air pressure inside. What do you think happens to that balloon if you take a pin and stick that rubber, sealed rubber container that's holding the air under high pressure? Gee, NASA, what happens to the balloon? Does it get cooler? No, it blows up. It blows up. Now, let's imagine that somebody actually would do this, drill a hole deep down into the magma, and then pump water in there. Back to my steel ball example, it would blow that thing sky high. So here's what would happen. It would not be one volcanic explosion. It would be two. The first one would take the steam, which is super steam, and I have this all in my webpage. I have an entire subpage dedicated to draining the lake at Yellowstone. The water, I talk in that article about superheated steam. Now, superheated steam is something that industries actually use. It's used in power generation at, for example, the coal-fired powered plants, where they superheat steam, and these are in very big steel containers, pressurized. And the superheated steam acts differently than regular steam. If you mix steam, regular steam, with water, the water will consume the steam. If you take superheated steam and mix it with water, the superheated steam changes the water into superheated steam. It acts differently. And also, it's a tremendously powerful force. If you take water and, like, say you took 50 gallons, the first 50 gallons of water that went down into that tube would explode with a force, just uncalculable force. And it would blow a hole through the top of the magma into, probably take it into orbit. But then, now you've got a hole in the entire lake of Yellowstone would drain down into that hole. And when that hit the magma, the whole lake would turn into super steam. Guess what, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, and the morons at JPL at NASA? You would create the biggest supervolcano the Earth has ever known. Now, they want to do this not with just Yellowstone, but all the supervolcanoes on the planet. When Mount St. Helens went off, now let me just give you the dynamics of a regular volcano. Mount St. Helens was about 2,000 times smaller than Yellowstone. The ash from Mount St. Helens ended up in New York City. There are people in New York City who were able to take a little vial of glass and fill it full of powder right off the street. That's how much fell in New York City from Mount St. Helens. But what happens, what precedes a typical volcano, is there's earth movement down deep. And what's going on there is the channels of underground water are moving around. And what does water do? It falls down into cracks and crevices. And so that rumbling, that is the water getting down into the magma and exploding. And that creates cavities, and so more water goes down, creates bigger cavities, and finally, when enough water falls down into a cavity and hits the magma, it blows the top of the mountain off. You know, it can go 50 miles high into the stratosphere. That's what a volcano is. But standard science doesn't understand these basic principles. Standard science thinks that when the magma gets warm, the gases that are in the volcano create the explosion, completely oblivious to the forces required. And if those gases were going to do something, they would have done it a long time ago. No, the problem is the way volcanoes work, the explosive ones, the way they work is the water in the water tables gets down, hits the magma, turns to steam, superheated steam, and becomes the biggest steam engine in the world. That's what a volcano is. Now you have the shield-type volcanoes, which you find in the Pacific Islands, for example, that are locally explosive. They are kind of spewing and sputtering, but they're not like the cinder cone types that explode. The volcanoes in Hawaii, for example, are shield volcanoes, and what you get there is just a big lava flow. Now, on all of the occasions of Yellowstone erupting, except for three, they were simply shield volcanic eruptions. In other words, they were lava flows. Nothing harmful. But those three occasions in which there was a supervolcano at Yellowstone, all three occasions were when there was a lake at Yellowstone. So, bottom line, we have to drain the lake at Yellowstone. And please, if you hear anybody, I noticed that the pages where this was released, there was no way to put a blog or respond to this idiocy. But if you see any of this, write me, let me know, etc. But we've got to put a stop to this idiotic idea that somehow they're going to pump water down and drill a hole and then pump water in. Like they're going to create the supervolcano. And like I said, when that first 50 gallons of water hits the magma, that's going to blow a hole probably about 200 feet wide. And the whole lake is just going to drain down there like pronto. And then you're going to see an explosion like the world has never seen before. And when now the you can see the steam engine at work when it blows all of this matter up into the stratosphere, literally pulverizes it, throws rocks the size of your house 20 or 30 miles or more. There's tremendous amount of power there. And it does not come from the gases that are in the magma. That's absurd. Those gases do not have expansive power like water does. The water is what causes the volcanoes to explode. So you get the water away from there, especially in a caldera like Yellowstone, and the most that's going to happen is a lava flow, which if it happened, then we could deal with that. But for someone to come along, now, secondly, don't you think that maybe they'd like to try this on a little teeny volcano? No. They want to go to the biggest volcano on planet Earth and do it. These people are crazy. These are the people that brought you the greenhouse effect and the dirty snowball comet model. Complete garbage science. And as I've mentioned on the radio, the greenhouse, there is no such thing as the greenhouse effect in the atmosphere. The greenhouse effect, let's look at a greenhouse. What is a greenhouse? And by the way, this is very provable with experiments. A greenhouse has a glass ceiling. The sunlight comes in, the air heats up, and the air cannot escape. So it continues to build up. What would normally happen? How do you cool down a greenhouse? You simply open up vents on the roof and the heat goes out and you cool down the greenhouse. So without that literal glass shield that prevents convection currents, in other words, the warm air from lifting up and leaving, without that glass ceiling there, you do not have a greenhouse effect. And so Earth does not have, nor does Venus, have a glass ceiling. And the clouds, as they draw in the pretty pictures in the textbook, are not a glass ceiling. They're subject to convective currents and the elimination of heat. And when it's cloudy, water vapor in the air, it's the heat content of the water vapor that maintains the temperature when it's cloudy. When you have a clear, dry sky, the temperature just goes whoosh. It goes up and goes away and goes out into outer space, literally. And if you have clouds, then the reason the air temperature tends to stay warmer, for example, on the desert at night, the temperature can drop very rapidly as soon as the sun goes down because there's no water content in the air. The thermal, the ability of the air, the dry air, to hold heat is very low. But if you bring the humidity up to 20, 30, 40% and then have cloud cover, which is holding that humidity in place, now the air has heat content and it's not going to lose that heat as rapidly. It's not a greenhouse effect. It's a heat content issue. And so once again, standard science has marched down the wrong road, tried to convince us all of global warming, which is a myth. And like I say, these are the same morons that brought you the dirty snowball comet model, which has been completely, completely disproven. There's no water, ice, snow on a comet nucleus. Little teeny patches, but they're not sublimating. They're just sitting there. You can see these little teeny patches of water on some comet nuclei. Some of them are bone dry and warm, too warm to have water. But the bottom line is there's nothing coming off the nuclei. I just made a posting that this is just horrendous, that the European Space Agency measured, and this was a NASA-designed instrument on the Rosetta mission, using microwaves to measure water around the nucleus of comet 67P, which is the comet that they orbited since 2014 and then had a lander land on it. When the lander landed, there was no water. There's nothing coming off the nucleus. It was hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in organic molecules. There's no water, not a drop of water, nor was there anything leaving the nucleus. To fill the tail of a small comet that we see the water from a distance in the tail, in the coma of the comet, the production rate that you would need from a dirty snowball comet nucleus is around 10 tons per second. 10 tons. Now, that would be a cube, a massive cube of water, but the nucleus would have to look like a steam locomotive, because remember, this water isn't just sitting there. It's supposedly being blown away in the solar wind. And so you need a production rate of water of about 10 tons per second. Okay, just remember that number, 10 tons of water per second on a small comet. NASA, with its instrument, measured a whopping 4 liters of water per second. That was their estimate. But they don't have any proof that that water was even coming off the nucleus. It was just in the vicinity of the nucleus. So they assumed it was coming off the nucleus. But compare 4 liters of water to 10 tons of water. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. So the measurement, they directly measured the water in the vicinity of the comet nucleus, and they didn't see 10 tons per second. Per second, no. 10 tons per second belching off. Remember the artist's conception back before anybody ever went to a comet? It had these amazing just shooting geysers and massive amounts of steam and coming off the comet nucleus, which they showed as being white with snow all over it. Well, you get to a comet nucleus, they're pure black, they're hot, they're dry. They don't have an ounce of water on them, on the small comet nuclei that they visited. Not a drop. And they have some little ridge areas where there's a little bit of water, but it's not sublimating. It's just sitting there. So once again, this is the crew of people that want to drill a hole into the biggest supervolcano on Earth, Yellowstone, pour water into it, the same people. So anyway, this has to be stopped. It has to be exposed. And these people have to be exposed for the idiots, the complete moronic idiots that they are. And what's disturbing is, if it weren't for this complete moron, Brian Wilcox, releasing this to the BBC, we wouldn't know that NASA sat in this meeting and decided that this would be a good idea. What else are they planning? What other good ideas do they have? They've destroyed outer space. They've wrecked outer space. It's a junkyard with all of NASA's junk up there. And all they would have had to do is divert that junk down into the atmosphere, and we would have had nice meteor streams every now and then with stuff burning up in the atmosphere, but it wouldn't be, you know, be the, you know, the massive junkyard orbiting Earth that we have. That's, you know, or landing on Mars or the moon with spacecraft that are full of bacteria and viruses from Earth, you know, contaminating entire planets before, you know, excuse me. And they want to drill a hole into a volcano and pour water into it. Anyway, this deserves some time, because this would be the end of the Earth for everybody. They would blow that volcano up. It would send any survivors would not have a good time. It would send Earth back into the cave ages, and the majority of the 7 billion people on planet Earth would be dead within 6 weeks maximum. Within, you know, a good portion of the United States would be destroyed in short order. But we can prevent all of this by draining the water out of Lake Yellowstone. So this is very important. If you do look at the events of Yellowstone, all of the other dozens of volcanic eruptions, which were just lava flows, they were local events. And, you know, it would not be wonderful, but the option is a supervolcano that would destroy half the United States. And then the clouds that would go into the stratosphere and all the rest of the secondary effects would kill off the population of the Earth very quickly. So anyway, I apologize for getting on my soapbox here on this issue tonight, but it's very important. This cannot be done. We cannot have people running around who don't have a clue what they're doing. And just to tell you, my new release will be coming out as soon as I get some of the loose ends tied up on it. It's an extremely important, timely, and I would say mind-bending release. I'm very proud of it. It's probably one of the most complex releases I've had. And to be honest with you, I was left for a couple of days last week on a short vacation, and I just needed some time off to relax. I've been under a lot of pressure, but it's self-induced pressure. That's the way I work. But sometimes I have to take some time off and just relax also, because science is what I do. That's my life. I choose to do it, but I do need a little time off now and then just to unwind. And a lot of good things going on in the background. As I've said before, this is probably, it's hard to compare because I've had very productive times throughout my whole life. But right now, I'm having a very extremely productive epic in my life. And things are really coming together, and this new book release is one of them. So I want to do it right. And when I release it, when I put it out, it's going to be in a final form. So just in summary, keep your ears and eyes peeled to my webpage, jmccsci.com, for the new release to come out. I'm hoping that's going to be any day now, but keep an eye there. The water filter sale is coming down in probably tonight, tomorrow, within the next day. And so that 10% plus an extra 5% off on the water filter products will go away. And plus, remember, the big sale also will go away on those extra filter elements for the large commercial grade filters. The filter replacement filters are at nearly half price. That sale is going to go away. So if you're interested in that, go to the webpage. And then also the wing generator, all of that. If you are interested in licensing or working on that, contributing, or if you know somebody with money to contribute, etc., to bring this to fruition, whatever is your contribution, email me and then we'll discuss it. And I have to basically clear everybody that I'm working with, but we're on the road to having this ready for commercialization, and all the help I can get is welcome, because there's very talented people out there. And so anyway, that's also coming. So lots of things going on. The webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.